From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
The new film called 10 Items or Less is about two people at turning points in their lives. One is an actor famous for his work in action films, but whose last movie was 4 years ago. And the other is a feisty checkout clerk at Archie's Ranch Market, a Latino community market in Carson, which is a poor town south of Los Angeles. Academy Award winner Morgan Freeman, whose previous films include Million Dollar Baby, Glory, Driving Miss Daisy, Unforgiven, and Bruce Almighty, stars with Paz Vega. You may have seen her in Spanglish or Sex and Lucia. It's written and directed by Brad Silberling, whose credits include Lemony Snicket's A Series of Unfortunate Events and City of Angels. And it opens today at the IFC Center on 6th and Waverly Place. It is with great pleasure that I welcome Morgan Freeman to my show today. Hello. Oh. But talk about being typecast. Don't you play an actor who's a lot like yourself?
Well, Brad wrote this. It's like an open script in that sense. I think whoever he had cast to play the role would find themselves very well bracketed in this character because it's just an actor. You know, whoever played it would be it.
But you brought a lot of yourself to this, I'm sure. Was there any improvisation involved?
No, we didn't do any improvisation in the film itself. There was an improvisational moment after the film when we're doing the credits, you know. But the film itself is all scripted.
And the character you play is called Him. He's a major movie star whose pickiness with his projects has kept him off the screen for 4 years. How do you avoid long lulls when the scripts that are offered to you aren't all that great?
The way this character describes himself, the pickiness gets beyond a certain level of pickiness. It becomes fear. Mm-hmm.
Does that happen?
Oh, yes. It can happen. Brad talks about having worked with Dustin Hoffman at one time, and then Dustin, you know, he was doing that. You just sort of, you look around and you've been holding yourself back for longer than 2 or 3 years. And things start to, you start sliding off of the radar. And I think in his case, him, this is what happened. It doesn't happen to me. I had my period of sliding off the radar back in the early 80s when I thought my career was on a upward trajectory, and then all of a sudden it just came to a screeching halt, and I thought my 15 minutes were up.
Why do you think that was? Because you'd already established yourself and
were
a highly respected actor.
Yeah.
And had all those other projects, Nine Me and Voiceover.
Well, that's now, not then.
It wasn't.
At the time, I was a struggling feature player, not a what you call a frontline actor. And I think it happened with me primarily when trying to analyze it after the fact. I was becoming problematic. Let's put it that way.
You were getting picky too.
Yes, very picky. Roles I was getting, and I'm putting this in quotes, colored roles.
And most of the characters you've played more recently don't seem to have been written specifically for African-American actors. Not this one either. So that was something that you actually aimed
for? Had to
for.
Transcend, mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, knock wood, my career did manage to transcend that. I was, you know, somebody asked me in a show one time about Black History Month. You know, and I have the same feeling there. You know, I just, it's It's a put down.
I always thought it was ironic that Black History Month is February, which is the shortest month of the year.
That's not the only thing that's ironic about it. What's ironic to me is that they just choose a period and say, okay, well, this is going to be the time we talk about it.
And then, yeah, then we don't talk about any of those issues for the rest of the year. We took care of it in February.
Yeah, exactly.
Your character travels to this grocery mart in Carson to research a possible role he's considering in a small indie movie project. And the trip is an extended dialogue. This film has a lot of extended dialogue. So can we say that this is more of a character-driven rather than a plot-driven film?
Oh, it was absolutely character-driven. Very charming, but character-driven all the way because there was not much of a plot. The guy goes to this store, he meets this young lady, and they just sort of, through circumstances, they spend the whole rest of the afternoon together. And in that short period, they have an effect on each other's lives.
Your character wants to find the essence of his character by studying the behavior of the folks who are at the store. You've said that you didn't need to do any research when you played the president in Deep Impact because we all know what presidents are like standing up there in a press conference. Here you're playing an actor who has to go to a supermarket to research being a store manager. I think we all know what store managers
conceit to get the guy out of his normal situation, you know, to get him out of his own comfort zone.
But have you ever researched a part?
Yes. In Lean on Me, I had to play a living person, and I researched him by that. I mean, he was there every day.
You went to the school.
We shot the picture in the school. So I had access to him every day. And I used to go in the morning and go find him and hold his hand. Because he's a very strong person, very strong personality, and a lot of energy. So I would charge myself with him.
And what about watching somebody who you're playing, the real person? Is there a tendency to try to be like that?
Oh, absolutely.
Person?
I think that's an absolute must. If you're going to play a real person, it behooves you to learn as much about that person's particulars as possible. You know, you cannot play. You can't play a living person without being able to somehow mimic them.
My guest is Morgan Freeman, who plays him, an actor, in 10 Items or Less, which is opening today at the IFC Center on 6th Avenue in Waverly Place. Used to be the Waverly. The supermarket he goes to, Archie's Ranch Market, feels like a place that time forgot. Nearly everyone seems to move in slow motion except Scarlett, the woman who is the cashier at the 10 Items or Less line. And she says to you that line is where checkers come to die.
Yes, it's where checkers come to die. Yes. Right. Yeah, because everybody wants to get into the fast lane, right? And she's very efficient, and she works very quickly. And so that is the fast lane. So people are always trying to sneak into her line with more than 10 items, of course, you know.
How did they find Archie's Ranch Market? Is it really that slow, or did you just empty it out and make believe that it was the sleepiest supermarket in California?
It was actually very slow. We're not able to buy a supermarket and say nobody can come in here. So it was open, but during the week, it's just a mother will come in with two or three of her children, and it's this big market, but very few people in it.
Now, this is really a two-character film. The other character is played by Paz Vega, who is incredible and incredibly beautiful, too. Mm-hmm. Had you seen her in any of her other films?
I saw her in Spanglish. I thought she was just absolutely delightful. And again, you saw a great chemistry between her and Adam Sandler. She's a wonderful actress, just wonderful to play with.
So you know from the start that this is somebody you're going to be able to play well off of?
Oh, yes. You get your impressions of actors from what they do, what you see them do. You know, you can feel it.
Because there are films, I've seen a fair number, where there's supposed to be chemistry and we don't feel it at all.
We don't feel it, right.
And
it,
even if the actors are great.
And very often when you don't feel it, it's because they don't feel it. So it's like anything else, you know. You read a book, and the first 10 pages don't get you, you're going to put the book down.
Has her English improved a lot over the years? Because
I remember when
she first started making films in America, she could barely speak English.
Yeah, when she did Spanglish, she couldn't speak English at all. She had learned the entire script through phonetics. But I'm amazed at people who come. This is the most complicated language of all languages,
right.
I think. And people come and they learn it just almost seems to me effortlessly.
Well, it would be like you deciding to make a couple of films in German and speak German well enough so that any German would understand what you were saying.
Precisely, and I cannot do it.
This is done through your production company. Aren't you planning to release the film online?
Yes.
December 15th through Broadband?
Yeah.
Well, won't making it available that way just weeks after its theatrical release hurt box office?
Why?
Because, I remember what happened with Steven Soderbergh's experiment, a similar experiment.
Yeah,
he showed it on television. And they seem to cancel each other out.
Well, but we don't think that they cancel each other out. What Steven did was day and date of release. What we're giving is a lead time. So the theatrical release will establish the film in the theaters. People who want to go to the theater will go to the theaters to see a film. I don't care what you do. If they were all of a sudden were going to stop going to the theater, they would have stopped at the advent of television. Mm-hmm. They would have stopped at the advent of the video cassette player.
And that was predicted again and again.
So it is our strong belief that this will continue just as it has been, and that this will just be another way to disseminate product, and that's room for everybody. The population is not receding, it's growing. And people like me, I live in a very rural area, very rural, but because I'm a member of the Motion Picture Academy, of course, I get pictures sent to me. Everybody
for your consideration, DVDs.
Exactly. But there are many people in my neighborhood, in my area, who don't. And I know this is nationwide, probably worldwide, that there are people who just do not have access. So a film comes out, there's a lot of buzz about it, people are talking about it, oh, it's a good film. But they say, well, when are we going to get to see it? Well, they won't get to see it for months because they're going to hold on to it and milk it at the box office until it's gone. And by the time it's come out on DVD, everybody's talking about something else.
And a film like this, which is a kind of a small film, charming, but something of an art film, that's less likely to be shown at the local multiplex anyway.
Exactly. Exactly.
Now, you've said that you dislike watching your own films. Was this different because you also produced it?
This is different because the film to me is very charming. I've been in one other film that I thought of as charming, and that was Driving Miss Daisy. This was a little bit different than Driving Miss Daisy. I played a specific character in Driving Miss Daisy. In this one, I don't play in a specific character. I'm just sort of floating through as a person, an actor. I don't like watching myself because I only see myself, and that's not fun.
But you've also said that you gravitate toward gravitas, and I'm not sure what you mean by that, but you seem to be having such a good time doing all of the comic bits in this film that... You obviously weren't gravitating toward gravitas here.
No, I gravitate towards gravitas, I think, because most of the films I have done, I have accepted parts that were a little denser, that carried more, drama with them. And so I have been offered a lot of parts like that, you know. So I have not been offered many comedies.
And one of the running jokes in this film is when your character comes upon one of his past action movies, you have a takeoff on something you did.
Yes.
With Ashley Judd. This one's called Double Dare, which he keeps on finding in discount racks.
Exactly. So,
which I'm sure also has happened to you. You've seen a film that was really important to you, and there it is being sold now, $3.99 or less.
Right, or less, exactly. Yeah.
My guest is Morgan Freeman, whose latest film is 10 Items or Less, directed by Brad Silberling and co-starring Paz Vega. and opening today at the IFC Center on 6th and Waverly Place.
We will continue it.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
We're back with Morgan Freeman, who is starring in a new film called 10 Items or Less with Paz Vega. And it opens today at the IFC Center on 6th Avenue, or Avenue of the Americas, if you insist, and Waverly Place. And will be then broadcast on December 15th, later online on December 15th. I'm not exactly sure how that is done. I do know that this is a... With the aid of Intel, do I just turn on my computer and look for 10 items or less?
Yeah, you just turn on your computer and you go onto internet and you go to cstar.com, which is ClickStar, the broadband distribution company that we own with Intel. And there you have access to a whole library of movies plus this one. And eventually the idea is that we would offer many first-run movies. A lot of movies are made by independent companies, and they just don't get distribution. So,
and how much are you going to charge for these?
Well, that I'm not really privy to, but I think that the model is sort of in the same realm as you can go online and get movies right now. There's going to be a little bit more than a library movie because it's now, mm-hmm. but it's going to be about what it would cost you to go to the movies to see it.
You said you discovered early on that you weren't cut out for playing romantic leads.
No, I didn't say that.
Well, I read that. And
did you?
Yeah.
In
an interview you did.
No, that's
In
not
fact,
so.
You said you did a movie once where you had to make love to a woman on camera and mm-hmm. you never want to do that again. You never said that?
I don't know if I said that. I may have indicated that sometimes when you're talking, you might misrepresent what you're saying. I enjoyed the experience, but this was a sex scene, and they're difficult.
Everybody thinks those are the easiest scenes.
You would think that they would be, but they're not. They're not. You know, it's they're not. I didn't find it the easiest scene to do, you know. I'm married. I'm working with a married actress, and we're carrying on. And you're what you're really attempting to do. I saw The Cooler with William H. Macy, who I think may be one of the best actors in the entire planet.
He's great.
And gosh, he just threw himself into that. And so they were the sex with his partner was totally.
What's her name?
Absolutely.
Is it Bella? I can't remember her name, but she's also quite beautiful.
I can't either.
But isn't that what acting's all about? Or is it the reason that sometimes marriages break up because people really get into the part?
Yeah. Yeah, I think marriages start because people really get into the part. You know, so many of us marry our co-stars and find out that, oh, that was then. That just was for that moment.
Looking back at your career, you go from the Air Force into theatrical work.
Not quite like that, but...
Well, had you wanted to be an actor all along when you were a kid?
Yeah. When I graduated from high school, high school yearbook said, you know, your name is under there, the most handsome, the most this, mine says actor. Because, mm-hmm. I've always been an actor.
And were you... You must have had some training. But do you think that some people are just born to be actors?
Yes, I think some people are just born to do it. Of course, you have training. You don't. You must learn how to speak. You must learn how to stand, move, adapt to different. If you're going to try and play different roles, you want to be flexible in both body and mind. I think it takes training. But I came to New York and I worked on the stage for 20 years, so you can't get better training.
You were in the Nigger Lovers and then later in the all African American production of Hello Dolly, so you had to sing as well.
Yes, yes.
But you wound up working on children's TV for a long, long time.
Thank heavens. Yeah.
Well, there probably was a good side to it, but there also is that fear that you get into a comfort zone, isn't there?
I did get into a comfort zone, and I was trying desperately for the longest time to get out of that comfort zone before it became a comfort zone, but problem with that turns out to be that it's hard to throw away work when there's none available. So there I was, kind of hoisted on my own petard, as it was.
Either way,
and I couldn't. I really could not tear myself away. Try as I did. I did try desperately. I would run off, you know, and try to hide so that I wouldn't have to do have that whole thing be thrown at you again. You
know? Well, anyone who has tried to make it as a freelancer knows the advantages and the disadvantages. But the disadvantage is that you can go a long time without working and you still got to pay the rent. So what was the big breakthrough for you?
After the fact or before the fact?
Well, were you able to break free? Did you just...
The show closed.
Uh-huh.
Mercifully, the show ended. And there I was. And it's oddly, strangely, as much as I protested wanting to be out and doing something else, I was desperately afraid that I was going to become one of those people who stayed with a job forever. And I really, really didn't want that, but didn't see how I was going to get it. And then, of course, the show became a success and lost its funding.
It's made by the same people who make Sesame Street, the Children's Television Workshop.
Right.
And you played Easy Reader, Mel Mounds, Count Dracula. You were all over the place. In an odd way, it's still acting.
No, it's acting, and it was great. We had this wonderful ensemble company, and we did all these different characters, and that was fun. But, you know, one of my nightmares was walking down the streets of New York in your 70s or 80s and having people wave at you and say, "That goes Easy Reader," you know.
So what was the, how did you break free?
Okay, I didn't break free.
The show closed.
The show closed, and then I had to go, I had to start all over again.
So you started acting
so
on theater
back,
again.
Yeah, and went to theater, went off Broadway, and started all over again.
Coriolanus and some other things. But then you started working in films, and I think only Meryl Streep has been nominated for more Oscars than you.
Oh, no. Many actors have been nominated.
Well, you had
four,
didn't you?
I had four nominations.
Before you finally won?
Uh-huh.
Did you think you would never win, or was it enough to win those nominations?
It became enough to win the nominations. After the second one, my whole concept of the idea of the Academy Awards began to shift because I resented... on a level, after the experience in New York of being awarded Obies,
mm-hmm.
I just thought that was the most civilized way of doing something like that. In other words, the Obies, they give out 5 awards or 6 awards or however many awards there are if they find the outstanding play or actor or director. They don't give one, they give as many as are necessary. I think if you can narrow 5 performances down to outstanding, and why choose those 5 and then make 4 of them losers?
But I thought you should have gotten an Oscar for The Pawnbroker. So, I mean, I've been a fan for a long time.
Oh, that is delightful. Okay, fine.
You could be seen for a second
if you should look very, very carefully.
But it is you got your first nomination for Street Smart in 1987. Yeah. Then there was Driving Miss Daisy in 1989. And then there was The Shawshank Redemption 1994.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally You know, it almost feels like they wanted to put you out of your misery. Because, but there were a number of others. You could have gotten one for Unforgiven, for example.
I feel the same way. I felt that way for the longest time, and it becomes fear that the Academy is going to award you. They're just going to give you something, and it might be for something less deserving than some of the others that you've done. You don't know. They'll just. Thankfully, Million Dollar Baby was a wonderful script, and
it all worked out.
It all worked out.
And also, working for Clint Eastwood has to be just thrilling because he's finally come to be accepted as one of the great directors,
premier directors of all. I don't think you'll find anyone who's ever worked with him who won't sing his praises to heaven. He's very masterful, and he's really hands off. To me, he hires you expecting you to do the work.
On the other hand, the movies all look beautiful. I mean, you'd think that an actor would be spending more time with the actors and less time with the visuals, but it's the other way around.
It's the other way around.
He's kind of like Don Siegel on The Next Generation.
Yeah.
He obviously learned from the best directors he worked with.
He told me that, one of the... Sergio Leone gave him an awful lot of help.
Well, made him famous with those spaghetti westerns.
But also when he's thinking about how to make a movie.
Was playing Hoke, the chauffeur in Driving Miss Daisy, tricky? You first did it off-Broadway, didn't you?
Yeah, we did it here.
And I gather that some Southerners would come up to you and tell you how nostalgic it made them feel.
I could always tell if the Southerners were in the audience because you'd hear weeping at the end of the play.
It was a comedy.
Yeah. Well, it was a comedy, but it was such a warm love story. The relationship between those two people grew so deeply over those 25 years, that they got it. The Southerners got it better than a lot of people.
But then there's that whole matter of the whether this character is an Uncle Tom or not. He obviously has to be obsequious as part of the job at that time. And that had to have made you feel a little uncomfortable at times.
No, not at all. I completely knew and understood that character. I grew up, in the South. My father worked as a chauffeur for a family, and I watched how Uncle Tom was a manipulator. That obsequiousness is a get over.
Now he's the strongest person in the play.
Mm-hmm.
I gather that one of the titles for Shawshank Redemption was Rita Hayworth and the Shawshank.
That was the original title. It came out of a novella written by Stephen King, and I don't know. I personally thought that was the better title than the Shawshank Redemption because even today people have trouble with that. When it came out, the few people who did see it would tell me, I saw that Shim Shunk Reduction, and it was a great movie.
On the other hand, it did get you an Oscar nomination, so enough people who mattered saw it. And sometimes that's more important than if the thing did incredible box office.
Somehow it had survived, because, I'm told it's one of the most watched movies on television. And it's on almost all the time. So, and people tell me that they've seen it 10, 15 times. So it has legs. It's a good thing. That's just called the long line.
Now, what's going to happen with you? You produced this film, mm-hmm. 10 Items or Less.
Co-produced.
The director and writer, Brad Silberling, said that this was great for him because it got him out of the studios, doing a location film like this. But what does it do for you, and where do you think you're going to go from here? You're going to do more movies of this sort?
Oh, absolutely. I think what it's going to introduce the whole concept of broadband distribution for first-run films. I think a lot of independent filmmakers don't get their films made because they can't find distribution. This will certainly going to alleviate that problem to a large extent. And I think that the way technology is moving today, this is obviously the next big move in content distribution.
But you got to do something big again, don't you? I mean, you did March of the Penguins. You did the voiceover for the American version of March of the Penguins.
Well, I mean, the next big thing that I'm going to do, big in my mind, is next month I'm going to start a picture with one of my all-time idols, Jack Nicholson.
Oh, great.
I get to work with him.
What kind of film is it?
It's a buddy film. We play two guys dying of cancer who go off to do the things that you always wanted to do before you kicked the bucket, and it's called The Bucket List.
Well, in this case, you also have a buddy film of a sort, only your buddy is Paz Vega.
Yeah.
And the film is 10 Items or Less, which opens today at the IFC Center on Avenue of the Americas in Waverly Place, and then on December 15th will be available online. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today, Morgan Freeman.
I want to thank you for a wonderful conversation.
So you repeat after me, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So please sit down.
Please sit down.
How do you do?
How do you do?
And this job's for me.
This job's for me.
The rest is poo.
The rest is poo.
Oh, please sit down.
Oh, please sit down.
How do you do?
How do you do?
This job's for me.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.